Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Federal Court Jurisdiction Over Denied Petitions and Applications. I'm J.J. Area, AWA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Zachary Nightingale, a member of the AWA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee, from San Francisco, California. Joining Zachary is Russell Abberton from Troy, Michigan, and Wesley Dellen, the American Immigration Council Business Litigation Fellow from Washington, D.C. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Zachary.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to today's podcast. I think we are very lucky to have two outstanding and experienced litigation experts to talk about the ins and outs, the do's and don'ts of challenging a denial that you get from CIS on an affirmative petition or application and how to bring that to federal court. Russell has litigated many cases in federal court, I'm told sometimes even successfully. He's been on AILA's amicus committee as a member or chair for 6 years, one of the most productive AILA committees, so that's like 18 years on any other committee. And Leslie has 20 years of experience in employment-based immigration, has been the business litigation fellow at the American Immigration Council since July of 2014, which is a key position she's going to tell us more about. So we're in for some really good discussion today, and I thank both of them for joining us. The aim of this podcast is to be enlightening and entertaining for about 30 minutes or so to give you an introduction to legal and strategic issues that we need to consider when preparing for a district court filing. So first, I'd like to ask both of you, what kinds of cases and what kind of denials are we even talking about? Can you tell us the top two or three kinds of cases that you usually either litigate or see being litigated in federal court? Leslie?
The American Immigration Council has a program to co-counsel with AILA members to litigate business immigration cases. And we identified H-1B and L-1 denials as what AILA members were primarily experiencing. In the H-1B, the denials are frequently because USCIS claims the job isn't a specialty occupation because USCIS fixates on the types of degrees the employer will accept. In L-1A, USCIS seems to have a bias against small companies that want to transfer managers to the U.S., and in the L-1B, USCIS often is unreasonably restrictive in its consideration of whether a job involves specialized knowledge.
And Russell, what have you seen litigated?
The cases that my clients are most anxious to litigate, the top one would be I-130 denials, usually because there's either fraud charge in the current marriage or a 204C fraud charge based on a prior marriage. A close second are I-140 ability to pay denials. And in third place, I have a tie of adjustment of status denials and naturalization denials.
Great. Well, that certainly gives us a large playing field and a large, wide variety of different kinds of cases that we can discuss today. And in our limited 30 minutes, we're probably not going to get to all of them, but hopefully we can get to the high points of these various kinds of cases. We hear a lot about mandamus at conferences and podcasts. Is that something that you both would use in a situation of one of these denials?
I would say no, because you're going to use mandamus when you need a court order to get the agency to make a decision on a petition or application that's been pending for a long time. And if you check out the council's website, you'll find a practice tip that was published earlier this month on when to consider mandamus, and we also have practice advisories on filing an immigration-related mandamus action, and specifically on mandamus actions against the Department of Labor.
And for those listening not familiar, I believe that's at www.AmericanImmigrationCouncil.org, and there's many practice advisories. Russell, did you have an opinion on mandamus?
Yes. Several years ago, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, when adjudication delays were very common, most often because of delayed background checks, we filed many, many mandamus actions. And I found that these were a good way to learn how to litigate cases in a much lower stakes environment. It allowed me to develop a good relationship with the assistant U.S. attorney who litigates immigration matters where I practice, and to learn the ins and outs of litigation and get comfortable with things like e-filing and the judge's rules. So mandamus is a good tool when it applies, but it differs from the Administrative Procedures Act in when it applies and the relief that's available.
So let's set mandamus aside, because the topic of this podcast is not supposed to be on the delay cases, as you both just mentioned, but on the denial cases. And so is the APA the way that you would go? And if so, what is that and how can you use it?
It is the way that I would go. The APA allows an individual or a company to challenge an adverse agency action. It's available unless there's a statute that precludes review or the action is committed to agency discretion by law. For example, in the context that we're dealing with, judicial review of removal orders has to be brought via petition for review under INA Section 242. And there are other provisions in the INA that preclude judicial review or at least significantly limit judicial review. For example, discretionary denials of 212H applications or adjustment of status applications. But the APA can be used to challenge a variety of agency actions that arise outside the context of removal proceedings, including the examples that we mentioned at the top of the podcast. It can also be used for things like denied work permit applications, denied adjustment status or waiver applications that are raising legal or constitutional errors. The APA can be found at 5 U.S.C., 551 and 701, and the provisions that follow those statutes.
And I would just like to note that of the ones we mentioned at the top of the podcast, I think naturalization is the only one that has its own special statute and jurisdictional provision to challenge in federal courts that I think, like removal proceedings, would be excluded from APA challenge, but all the others, I think APA is the way to go. Would you guys agree?
I agree. And 1421C, which governs naturalization appeals, is a much better statute to litigate under as compared to the APA, because the naturalization appeal statute provides for de novo review. And under the APA, it's a much more deferential standard of review.
So that's important to know. Leslie, are there other basic APA rules to keep in mind?
Well, you do have a time limit, but it's generous, because generally you'd have to file within 6 years of the denial, but you know your client isn't likely to want to wait that long, so that shouldn't present much of a problem. You also have to figure out if your client can sue, and that you have to have a legal capacity to sue, and people probably recall that that's called standing. And for an APA case, a party has to have both constitutional standing under Article 3, which is a specific injury the court can redress, and also be within the zone of interest. the party has a right to sue an interest under the applicable statute. And for APA claims, that's also a very minimal standard. And since we don't have a lot of time, I'd ask you to check out our practice advisory on litigation for business immigration practitioners, which discusses the standing in more detail. So the petitioning employer is clearly going to meet both of those standing requirements. And there are also good arguments that the beneficiary has standing to sue, both for non-immigrant and immigrant visa petitions. And there was a recent decision, TENRAC, in the district court in Oregon, which is the H-1B visa lottery challenge, and it found that H-1B beneficiaries have standing, and it also discussed the immigrant visa petition cases, giving standing, finding standing in reaching its decision on the non-immigrant.
So that sounds like a really important issue that could probably stand to have its own podcast one day. But for the time being, the practice advisory that Leslie's referring to was issued June 3rd, 2016, entitled Litigation for Business Immigration Practitioners, and is also available on the American Immigration Council's website. And it was authored by Leslie and Melissa Crowe. So thank you for pointing out that to us. And what about venue for those of us for whom civil procedure was a long time ago, and these concepts are a little nebulous now?
Well, once you know who has standing to sue, then we have to figure out where we sue, and that's venue. Venue here is governed by 28 U.S.C. 1391A1 because a government agency or government officer will be a defendant. And venue is proper where a defendant resides, where a substantial part of the events or omissions giving rise to the claim occurred, or where a plaintiff resides. Usually in immigration cases we're not dealing with property, but that if property is involved, and that can also be a site for the venue. What we find is that in many cases there are multiple places that we can file. If there are more than one plaintiff in a case, such as an employer and the employee, they may be in different locations. The USCIS office that adjudicated the application may be in a third location. And also Washington, D.C. can be a choice for venue. When choosing venue, I will run down a number of different considerations. If I have a choice of different federal circuits, I will review the case law in those circuits to see which one would be most beneficial to the issues that I plan on raising in the case. If there are courts or judges that have ruled on similar issues before, that's good to know, for better or for worse. In employment-based federal litigation, a well-known company may want to file in their home district because the judge may be familiar with the company and the benefit they provide to the community. If you're not licensed to practice in a remote district, you'll want to review the requirements to become licensed in that federal district court because different jurisdictions have different rules about admission to practice. Some won't allow an out-of-district attorney to become licensed there. Instead, they'd have to appear pro hac vice and retain local counsel, all of which can add to the expenses for the clients. Usually we settle on filing in where I practice, which is either the Eastern or the Western District of Michigan, but in some cases it'll make more sense to file in a distant location.
So the agency process, we all know from experience, can be quite a slow one. And if you get a denial and then you file an administrative appeal to the either to the BIA for an I-130 or the AAO for a petition that is appealed there, that could further delay the adjudicative process. what are our options if we are convinced the agency has made a mistake? What are our options for going directly to federal court?
In some circumstances, there are mandatory exhaustion requirements, meaning that before you can go into federal court, you have to exhaust an administrative remedy. The seminal Supreme Court case is Darby versus Cisneros. It's a 1993 decision at 509 U.S. 137. Under that decision, an agency decision is deemed non-final only when an administrative appeal is expressly required by statute or when an agency rule requires an administrative appeal before judicial review and the administrative action is made inoperative pending that administrative review. So, for example, a naturalization appeal, which is filed under 1421C, requires that there first be an administrative appeal. There's a Sixth Circuit case, Schweika versus DHS, 723 F3rd 710, where a naturalization appeal was dismissed because it was filed prematurely because the naturalization applicant didn't exhaust that administrative appeal. On the other hand, there's no statute that requires an I-130 petitioner to appeal to the BIA before challenging the USCIS's decision in federal court. Another Sixth Circuit case, Bangura versus Hansen, 434 F3rd 487, addressed that situation where the I-130 petitioner skipped the BIA, and then the Sixth Circuit found that they had jurisdiction to review that challenge and rejected an exhaustion argument made by the government. The same with an I-140 denial and these non-immigrant application denials, because there's no statutory requirement to appeal to the AEO. And moreover, these decisions are not rendered inoperative while an administrative appeal is pending. In the context of an H-1B or an L-1, the non-citizen status may have expired and the pending appeal won't serve to extend their status here or provide authorization to work in many cases. So there's sometimes a choice between appealing to the administrative agency like the AEO or the BIA or going into federal court when exhaustion is not required. An interesting issue, though, arises with an I-45, the adjustment of status denial. There's no right to appeal an I-45 denial in most cases, but there is a right to renew that application in removal proceedings. And that raises the question of whether a denied adjustment of status applicant has to exhaust that remedy by going through the removal proceeding process and then challenging that denial via a petition for review from an adverse BIA decision.
Have you had problems on a jurisdictional basis in trying to make that challenge and having a federal court tell you, I don't have jurisdiction because you must challenge through the removal process first?
I have had some problems with that, and the case law that I've reviewed is mixed. In some cases, courts have found that exhaustion is mandatory. In other cases, they've found that exhaustion is prudential and just declined to review the adjustment denial. I think where the exhaustion requirement is weakest is in situations where the applicant's not amenable to removal proceedings because she's already maintaining status, such as an asylee or in TPS, or they have non-immigrant status, or where ICE is exercising its discretion to not initiate removal proceedings, something that's more and more common now. And a case that I would rely on is Sackett versus EPA. It's a 2012 Supreme Court case. In Sackett, the plaintiffs were fined by the EPA, and although they had a right to seek administrative review, their ability to do so was contingent on the EPA initiating that administrative review process, which might never happen. And during the interim, they would be subject to increasing fines and penalties, which is similar to someone whose adjustment status application is denied. They can't renew it in removal proceedings because ICE has sole control over whether or when to do to initiate those proceedings. And in the meantime, they're unlawfully present, they're without work authorization, and they might be subject to other sanctions. And that, in SACA, the Supreme Court found that the initial compliance order that was being challenged was a final agency action for which there's no adequate remedy other than APA review. I'm not aware of that case being relied on in immigration APA actions, but I think it would fit nicely into an APA action to challenge an adjustment of status denial.
And that's a really good point, that when looking for case law precedents, we don't want to limit ourselves specifically to immigration cases. And there are certainly parallels in other areas of administrative law that actually may have come up more frequently since federal immigration litigation, though increasing, is relatively rare. Leslie, what are some of the other factors you look for when advising practitioners whether to take that administrative appeal or go directly to federal court?
Well, one thing I just want to mention quickly is even though you may not be required to appeal, if you do utilize another administrative remedy, generally, if you think you now want to go to court, you should either withdraw that action or wait for a decision, because otherwise most courts are going to dismiss, and that's what was referred to as prudential exhaustion. The court will say, well, let the agency finish first. But I have heard from some ALA members that they have been successful in convincing a court that it should proceed. There's a practice tip on our website about whether to appeal to the AO, and I hope by next week there's going to be an updated practice advisory, which also has updated circuit by circuit cases, which may be helpful. In terms of the strategy of whether to go, the AAO is usually, they have a track record of most often affirming denials, so you probably aren't going to want to appeal unless you think from reviewing the denial that there's more information that you could provide, that you're seeing that now there are gaps, or maybe you could supplement what you already have. And that's important for two reasons, because one, the AAO may decide that they can reverse the denial, but probably more importantly is even if you lose at the AAO, you're going to have a much stronger record to take to court. And since you're limited when you go to court to whatever you submitted to USCIS, that's what becomes the administrative record, this is your last chance to add to that record, because the court's going to decide whether USCIS acted reasonably in denying from that evidence that you submitted with your petition. One other reason you may go to AO, if it's really obvious, let's say the service center clearly overlooked the document that clearly shows that the petitioner's entitled to get that classification for the beneficiary. If you appeal, the service center is going to look at that record first, and they may go ahead and review the file before the case gets forwarded to the AAO. But otherwise, I'd suggest going to court.
Okay, so moving right along, you have your denied petition. After the denial, let's say you want to add some more, so you file the appeal with new evidence, new argument, whatever it is, and the AAO, of course, still denies, as you might expect, and you realize you need to go to federal court. Your petitioner is in a good district, so you file your lawsuit there. You prepare your APA complaint. You call that U.S. attorney that you have a good relationship with, but they don't even want to discuss the merits of the case because you haven't filed yet. So you go ahead and file. You figure out how to serve the government defendant. Then what? What can you expect once you file in federal court?
Well, this is the fun part. The government, which is called the respondent in these proceedings, Normally our clients are the respondents, but not now. So before you copy and paste from any briefs you have, make sure that you change respondent to plaintiff or your party's name.
Nothing ruins your reputation faster than calling your client by the wrong name.
Right. The government has 60 days to respond to the complaint. And in my experience, they will use that full 60 days. They may call to discuss the case. They may ask for more time, especially if it's a clear error and the agency is trying to figure out how they can fix the mistake and reopen, sua sponte, reopen, and usually approve it or maybe deny it under more airtight grounds. But assuming they file an answer, it means that they're going to litigate the case and they're going to oppose your APA complaint. Each judge handles things somewhat differently, so I would recommend going to the district court's website and looking under the page for your particular judge to see how he or she proceeds, what their sample case management or standing orders look like. But generally, the judge will issue a case management plan directing the parties to consult and issue a joint 26F scheduling order, which contains things like whether discovery is necessary, whether there's issues that can be resolved with a motion to dismiss, or whether motions for summary judgment will be filed. These 26F plans are crafted, I think, for normal civil cases where there might be a jury and there might be comprehensive discovery. APA cases are much more straightforward. Generally, what ends up happening is the cases are resolved on cross motions for summary judgment and followed sometimes by oral arguments or perhaps a hearing, but then by a written decision from the judge. The government files the administrative record. They'll usually file it under seal because of the district court's redaction rules. No one wants to go through and redact dates of birth and social security numbers and things like that from 500 pages of an administrative record. So they'll file it under seal so the general public can't get access to it, which is normally good for your clients anyway. They don't want this information out there for the public to see. There's very little or usually no discovery beyond submission of the administrative record because the district court will decide the case on the record that was before the administrative agency. I would carefully review the record that is filed by the government to make sure it is, in fact, the full record, that everything that you've submitted or your client has submitted is part of the record. If it doesn't include everything, or if you think submission of additional documents are necessary, such as agency memos or the adjudicator's field manual or liaison minutes or training manuals, you can submit them either as an exhibit or as a part of a request to supplement the record or ask for further discovery to uncover those records. You want to be careful that you're not submitting records, documents that are going to undermine your case, but if an agency decision is contrary to its own guidance, that's certainly an issue you'd want to raise as part of the APA complaint. The judge may, if your case is particularly strong or sympathetic, a judge may schedule a pretrial conference to engage in some arm twisting of both sides to try to resolve the case short of having to issue a decision. Otherwise, the case will go forward to a decision, and depending on what the decision is, the case proceeds from there.
And Leslie, how often or what can you expect if the government actually wants to negotiate?
Well, usually the government may want to talk about whether there's a way to narrow the issues. I found that tends to happen more in FOIA cases than in the regular petition denial cases that I've worked on, but you should be open to discussions with the government. Russ has really covered so thoroughly the steps after filing, but I just wanted to add in the business cases, while you will normally go on cross motions for summary judgment, the government first will, instead of answering, will often file a motion to dismiss, and they'll either try to argue that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, sometimes making what I think are very extreme arguments to try and say that any decision that they make is discretionary, which you can you usually can successfully shoot that down because there's a lot of good case support for the position that in the petition adjudication area, there are objective standards and regulations that the agency is supposed to be following, and so that even though all decisions have some discretionary component, there are objective standards that the court can review. Or the government in its motion to dismiss will say, well, the court can't award you any relief. The easiest example, which is not business, but like with diversity visas, if you get past September 30th, the court's going to say, well, you may have a point, but I can't do anything about it. But normally you're going to go on cross motions for summary judgment, and it may be after you file your motion that the government wants to sit down and talk about settlement.
Leslie, if a petitioner has questions on how to respond to, let's say, a motion to dismiss or what evidence should be presented before the agency, is that the kind of thing that ALA members can contact you at the American Immigration Council?
Absolutely. I am available to consult on strategy, even if you're not talking about federal court, but you just want some advice on what do I do now that I've gotten a denial. I'm happy to discuss that with people. I was wondering, could I back up one moment pre-complaint, because I wanted to stress, even though we've mentioned it, that it's really important before you file suit to check the case law. And Russ mentioned this, but you really need to look at the case law as you're deciding which court you're going to file in, because what you're dealing with in an APA case is the government. The court is not making its own decision about how the agency should have decided. If the court could look at it new, the court might reach a different conclusion, but the court's looking at whether what the agency did was reasonable, and there are different levels of discretion that may be applied when the court's thinking about what the government did. And some courts are always highly deferential to the government, and other courts understand that there are different levels of deference depending on the source for the agency's interpretation.
So that's a really good point, that you not only want to be familiar with the precedent, perhaps unpublished cases as well, the history of the judges in the particular district in which you have venue, but at the same time, there may not be that history, and you want to research your best arguments for the appropriate level of deference, because this is something that government attorneys love to raise, that judges, you should just automatically defer to what my client, the government, did, and don't question it. And I think we can all expect that's a really common response and something we all have to be sort of ready to address.
And just one more strange thing that occasionally happens, and I have to stress that it's only a few cases, but it has happened to a couple of ALA members, that after you've gotten your denial and you go, okay, I'm going to court, all of a sudden the service center sends out a request for evidence, and you're going, how can this happen? I have a final decision. But unfortunately, a couple of courts have said, oh, okay, now this isn't final, and we want to give the agency a chance to resolve it, and they have actually dismissed complaints, and the members find themselves back in front of the agency. So luckily, it's not a trend, but members should know about it.
So on that note, with only a couple minutes left for this podcast, can each of you share with us, you know, some unexpected or surprising results that you've received or seen attorneys receive after filing in federal court?
Well, you know, in the case that jumps out for me was in the 1421C naturalization appeal context. It was a situation involving a 751 that was approved after a very long process because the non-citizen was a child who immigrated through a marriage that the government alleged, through a parent's marriage where the government alleged that that her father entered into a sham marriage with a U.S. citizen. And she immigrated separately and had her own 751 petition. That was finally approved, and it seemed like everything was great, and so she could apply for citizenship. And then the agency starts threatening to reopen the 751 approval, claiming that they made a mistake in approving it. Fortunately, we had a great judge who understood the sympathetic nature of the case and brought myself and the government's attorney into a conference and chambers, sort of like in Law and Order. He really put the screws to the government's attorney and made it known that if they were going to proceed with the case, that he was going to issue a decision that they wouldn't be happy with. And lo and behold, a week later, the agency contacts us through the government's attorney and says that they are going to approve the naturalization application. So we were able to eventually dismiss the federal appeal, and she was able to naturalize and everything.
Don't you just love it when you're on the right side and the right thing happens? Leslie, have you had a similar surprising or unexpected experience?
I have a great example of an ALA member's success, not my own. Before I mention it, I just want to tell everybody there's another practice advisory on just generally not business, but immigration lawsuits and the APA, and it tells you about the basics of a district court action, so it's another good reference. Well, this ALA member, and she had never litigated in federal court, she was so furious when she received a denial in which the USCIS, without using the word, basically accused her client of fraud. It was an H-1B petition, and the denial said, well, petitioner, you're not really going to be employing the beneficiary, and on like that. So she filed suit, and all of a sudden she gets an approval notice just shortly after she filed. She gets an approval notice. The CIS went from fraud to approving the petition for 1 year. Now, she was really looking for 3 years, but, you know, what changed? She filed suit.
Well, on that note, we should all be encouraged to stand up to government incompetence and to government error, and feel free to use Leslie and the American Immigration Council as a great resource. Many attorneys have done so and have had the success that she just related, and give it a shot. And I remind everybody to look for the updated practice advisory on this topic from the council coming very soon. But in the meantime, thank you, everybody, for joining us, and that concludes today's podcast.